Well, the grand finale is coming up. Robert Boyd has taught writing at St. Louis Community College at Merrimack for nearly 30 years. His reviews, essays, stories, and poems have appeared in many publications, among them The Nation, Chicago Tribune, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Los Angeles Times, and many literary magazines of kind of a wide and varied stripe. Drama reviews can be heard regularly on KDHX-FM, that great station on the far left of the dial, where you can hear on Wednesday night River Styx poetry programs, Poetry Beat, and Literature for the Halibut at 7 o'clock. He is the recipient of the Guy Owens Prize for Poetry from the Southern Review and the inaugural Missouri Writers' Week Prize for Poetry. I'm very happy to have here at Duff's. Please welcome Robert Boyd.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you all for coming. I will warn you that my poems fall into two categories. One is wild and chaotic, and the other was described by a helpful editor as hyper-academic bullshit. I'll try to steer a course between the two, but I do write with tongue-in-cheek a lot. I cast out words like bright flies tied to lure the poems lurking in the murky water. They're great at stealing bait, but now and then I hook one, reeling it, wriggling and iridescent aloft, gleaming and gasping in the lethal air. Holding on in a howling wind. Today there's wind that comes from everywhere at once, scratching at the tin roof, kicking up the dust in the corral, whipping a Wonder Bread wrapper from the trash miles off toward the willows at the bend where we'll find it months from now and take it as an artifact of head-high floods, hung out to dry, red, white, and blue, saying bodies can be built so many ways. But spring will bring all that around. For now there's someone's Stetson hat making for Texas like a frostbit duck. And there he runs off after it. Or maybe he's in flight himself, swimming in that wind like a scarecrow, his arms like windmill blades, the range grass raging at his feet like surf, the plains slate gray behind him, flat and deep. A series of poems as in the form of letters to my children, and this one, and there are three of these tonight. This is called A Letter to My Daughter for Valentine's Day, and it's the poem that the Missouri, that won the inaugural Missouri Writers' Week Award. Midwinter, and a sadness sags my bones and slows my heart and will not go away. Straight as the stony path to heaven's gate, the narrow days dawn, dangerous with ice, which warns, look to this moment, nothing more. Do you remember Thais, who converts to Massenet's sweet music, drawing life around her down to holy symmetry and sweet remorse? I sit bewildered, full of choices made and doubted, all those dull decisions heaped on duller ones, and know the rising sun can light me nothing new, and all that changes will remain the same. I wonder how one makes a choice that leads so far through winter wilderness, and toward what distant mountains one might go to find respite. Please forgive this self-abuse. The next time I write, I will send you a bracelet made of polished stones that gleam and glitter in the warming sun. Letters to My Children, now number three. This is called The State of the Farm in Fall. And it shows you how much of a bullshit artist I am because I've never been on a farm. It's a cool idea. October, and the pond's gone up in flames of sweet gum, sumac, maple, elm, dancing in the yellow light and in the wind. The green purse of our valley holds it in, or else its fire would spill down field and track and set the lower world ablaze. The very birds, I swear, who lit the match last year, choir in the trees around the burning lake like boys at barn fires, laughing and afraid. Beyond the dazzling hills, the winter clouds, low and flat and gray, are gathering. They'll quench our spirits in due time. Meanwhile, come and sit with me in your imagination, as I like to think you did when we were young. We'll pitch small stones into the pond and watch the gold flames shatter and reform and laugh like autumn birds who've paused to rest up for the next and further flight at what has passed and what may be to come. This is a new piece. For some reason, the block has gone away, and I've been making some things that I like lately. Another letter to my children. This is number 6, and the title is London in Freefall. They say now there will be a Ferris wheel twice as high as Big Ben's tower just on the south bank at Westminster Bridge by year's end. That's to say, Disneyland upon Thames, the final win for Roy and Walt's uncomplicated vision of what floats our boats. And I don't doubt some HRH will dedicate the thing, a shining toy exemplifying science in the service of mankind, at least as far as science understands what mankind is or how to serve. Now I, who vacillated all my life, I'm sorry, between the views of Blake and Newton, I, for whom the keyboard means music one moment and the dance of text the next, I, who in the third and final place find rhetoric too often can make up for substance, I, your father, Nestor in a tweed sport coat, confront you like Ulysses on the plains of Troy confronted Agamemnon, and I say, London, children, has stepped out a door into blue air without a parachute and does not know what to make of the rush of air that lifts its skirts and musses up its hairdo as it falls. It does not think about the hard ground, for the clouds it's falling through are fair and in the latest shapes and shades, and everyone else is falling too, so why should London be afraid? But the truth is out there, looking up with yellow eyes out of the dark, watching London growing larger by the hour, standing slightly to one side in deference, but armed and ready to close in when Westminster crashes on the pointed rocks, when Big Ben is shards and twisted steel, when South Bank is scattered on the squalid floor. I did a chapbook called Snapshots from My Family Album, and not being able to leave anything alone for very long, I add to that from time to time. This is number 30 in that series, and it's a new one about my father's grave. It's called Snapshots from My Family Album, number 30, My Father's Grave. On my father's grave, as you can see, there's no headstone, only the slab put down 50 years ago to mark the place my infant sister occupies within my mother's father's family plot. Look carefully, however. By that tiny stone, you see a round disturbance in the grass, a plug of turf that caps a 2-foot hole, about the width of post holes, like the ones we hacked out, he and I, one August, in the hard-baked clay of our meager city yard, to fence the lively little dog he bought to help mother forget about this dying child, whose punctured grave his potted ashes newly share, who now his mentor in the ways of death, rides him upon her belly as he once rode her. I write about travels too. This is about London. Soho, as you may or may not know, is sort of the East Village of London, the red light district, among other things. Soho, in the unaccustomed air of Sunday dawn, old Compton Street still as a churchyard, condom foils and lager cans and fast food wrappers come to grief in its weeping gutters, but everywhere the pure and holy light descending, falling patiently upon the window shades and sills of sleeping whores, upon the motley awnings of the live sex bars, upon the betting agent's shops, the takeaways, the kiosks of cheap souvenirs, shuttered all against its blessing, but in vain, for silently this light will work its way within through crevices too thin to find or plaster up,
By threads and tendrils it will enter into buskers, bawds, and grifters all as it is meant to do, just as it will to saints in gloomy corners of the Greystone Church, and inside, outside, in the fall, upon the wretched and impenitent, the sinners and the filthy streets of Soho on a Sunday morning. Teach us what the battered heart might have of grace had it the wit to wake and know. This poem is a game. I wrote a poem called My Father Fishing, and then I imagined what one of my children might write about me, and I wrote a poem called My Father, the author of My Father Fishing, Fishing. In the basement room, where boxes were lined up and stacked like jetty stones, my father fished his Saturdays away, intending always to just bring back up a letter, poem, monograph, a tale, a manuscript, an off-print, Xeroxed sheaf of disconnected fragments, long since sunk below the silt and murky flow of consciousness, like a flounder nestled in, leaving the merest outline in the sand. And sure enough, before the first box full had poured out on the floor, he'd have a strike. Never the one he'd gone for, but some flash of half-forgotten thought, a phrase up near the surface, glistening in sun. Hours later, there he'd be, when I dove down to help him lug the day's catch home, reading words he'd written years ago, with yellowed manuscripts around him on the floor like minnows belly up in muddy shoals, the bits and pieces of his fractured gift, reviews and interviews, light verse tossed away in local papers, essays done for little checks as dead as alewives, with less to say. That room, a mermaid's womb of tears, would drown him. Yet his breathing bubbled up toward the silver interface of sea and air, the liquid mirror that reflected down his image, failing body and unruly hair, suspended in the amniotic brine, not fish, not fisherman, not the world's, not mine. Okay, those were all hyper-academic bullshit. Now I'm going to throw in a couple of wild ones. These wild ones tend to begin, dear friends, and if you think of them as kind of many sermons, you'll be on the right track. I'm a frustrated preacher, in a sense. First one is new, and it's called Art in a Time of Fever. Dear friends, yet once again the laurels yield us up their berries, and I'll brew them in a tea where from an essence redder still than blood I'll draw, and then I'll with it draw upon this page, this very page. On the computer screen, says Janet, brushing back her wings, and I suppose that would be a land page, but no one's likely to remember Vikings in these piping times of peace. This page, I continue, ignoring as usual her frippery, her wiles, a timeline of my life, which would embrace the age of darkness years before TV brought games out of the stadium and into family rooms and trickle toward, in sharp, uncertain turns, the present networked intercourse in which a poem is a moment when the inward flow of voice and motion shuts off for a while, leaving a time out in the active soul which must be filled, a midden, open for things that haven't been ignited yet or just won't burn. Do you know what you're going to say before you start a sentence, Janet asks, or is this like watching Jackson Pollock paint? But I believe with what's left of my heart in magic, and the point at which heat flashes into fire and light begins, and that the light from the merest sparks together casts the shadow of the world upon the vast and dusky curtains of the void, and Janet's whistle shrieks above me on the shelf from her accustomed perch. Shit. Friends, cannot a man dilate upon a metaphor sans the whine of reason without some fairy referee sending a ratto to the free thought line for one and one, leaving me pacing the hardwood at nothing but by the bench, about to throw a chair at nothing but the empty space where lately my team was smoking word and thought, fast breaking toward the dark team's goal, bearing on their brilliant shirts the numbers that arranged aright might unlock at last my ancient dream of making something work. But meanwhile, care to dance? In March, big games bring marching music, but the aftermath is April, winding down toward May, when dancers enter in, on point, all cosmopolitan, their art inscribed like mine on empty space,
goalposts and backboards taken down and in their place maypoles erected on the green, beribboned and adored by virgins with their baskets full, who only days ago wore miniskirts and led the poems of the roaring crowds, which must amount to something workable, I think. But working is the focus, after all, not play, and surely not the silliness the dancers do. The work that we are doing, like folks making love, filling the empty middens of their souls with movement towards significance, like coach and player with their diagrams, entering each other's skins, the one the schemer and the maker up of plans, the other, this is you, the power that can make the words come true. This is another wild one called A Lesson on Maps. First, friends, let us orient ourselves by finding out true north. This we can do by falling on our shadows at high noon, by looking for the mossy sides of trees, or by waiting until dark and sighting down the great bear's leg. And failing that, says Christopher, irreverent, we could call it the nearest Texaco, a different sort of star, but nevertheless effective, and just ask which way it is. But having found direction, let us spread our maps with the white space at the top so that the green and brown fall in like strata just below, and the names of all our places, right side up, are clear to us. Now we may begin. But, says Janet, small and eager, there's some white down there as well, and so there is. The southern band of ice that on a globe resolves into Antarctica, the other side of things. The name means against the bear, says Christopher, and we believe he's right, or close enough, so we see at once that there are polar bears at one end and anti-polar bears at the other, and if the two should come together, theoretical physicists predicting cataclysm would dominate the evening news for sure. But back to the map itself. In fact, there are three sorts of lines, to wit. The wrinkled lines in blue, like roots or branches joining in a stem, are arteries and veins God's hand has traced, or time has worn in stone, which we may observe is to say one thing, to lead our juices to the heart and out again. See where they blossom into pools. Here we create concrete infarctions and lap the water up to wash our cars or make the front yards green, leaving the nearby land to atrophy, becoming T-shirt shops and bankrupt condominiums. Next are lines made by abutting blocks of rose and yellow, green and orange. These we call borders, lines we've drawn with instruments called treaties and keep with instruments called bombs to wall ourselves away from those we do not trust, whose dialects diverged from ours 10 generations back and so are alien. What is it that maps, after all, record, muses Christopher, if not our failure to love? But our attention now is drawn to the grid of lines, each straight and finely drawn, by which the world is made coordinate, by which the teacher with the stick can easily articulate location, know the time, predict the tides, the angle of the sun. These are the marks of minds predestined to analysis, minds not content with having, but possessed by need to know for knowing's sake, surest of middle parts, uncomfortable with tiny things that don't obey the laws. Quarks and babies, Janet says, they're all alike. And baffled by whatever's large, like hurricanes and deserts, not to mention stars, we're happy when the lines meet at right angles and all ends are neatly joined and order reigns. We're willing victims of our self-deception, votaries of order in the teeth of ignorance. May I please be a votress? Janet sensibly requests, and we assent, it being one more nail in the coffin of complacency, presuming always that irregularities exist only because we let them, having yet more work to do, that chaos is a failure of our information gathering. The map says, I am paper of a dream. I am replica unlike the thing itself a thousand ways, flat where it is not. Make me a globe, still I defy the spheroid truth. All I prove is what you want to see. You cannot know the earth through me. Go out and touch it. Find in your flesh what is true beyond the knowing and beyond the wish. One more of these to do, a little bit longer, another narrative called Christ and the Woman Taken in Adultery. Dear friends, let's go back to Galilee toward evening on a sort of average day, with the shade already beginning to pool in the elbows of the walls and the fruit green and amber in the stalls, the dust and the beasts settling down, the time when the shutters open like eyelids and women peer from the shadows inside to gauge the day's progress by what's drifting by in the street, each sailing her own course. "Don't get too figurative," says Janet in her piping voice, and so I won't. But let me set the scene. There in a courtyard, let an ancient tree arch over it for dramatic effect, a group of elders gather, murmuring. A woman has been taken in adultery. There's been a breach of law. There must be punishment. To one or more, perhaps, it is a chance to gun for bigger game. The silly carpenter who's been around these parts too long with his trash about mercy and the meek and his disrespect for the order of things. "But don't make them seem like evil men," says Janet, shifting to the front of her perch on the shelf above my books. "The thing is, they were afraid of him." "And watch your tone," says Christopher, materializing as usual with no invitation. "You get preachy when you get sincere. But here's their plan. They have this girl they've caught fucking someone other than her owner out behind some yellow barn, squirming in the dust with his beard scratching her face and the flies all over them just until he's through. And now the judges have her, manacled perhaps and facing certain death, but reprieved while they bicker about strategy. So what's new," says Janet, and I must agree. "Let's say that listless with the exhaustion of terror, she stands like a cow waiting to be moved down through the rocky streets outside the walls to a grove of trees where Jesus is camped with the 12, speaking today under the big white tent to a score of restless poor folks about the harsh kind of love that folds us in and asks us to give up ourselves." And for a time, the two groups interleave. Then someone among the rabbinate stands up in the middle of a long and dreamy line about worlds beyond this world and thrusts his challenge into the text like a sword, cutting it off to pose a cunning paradox of evil and the law. And to make a point, they drag her out, numb beyond fright, and force her up against the wall and to her knees, then all grab stones of the proper heft with justice rising in their craws, adrenaline stretching the tendons in their forearms taut. They turn to him and wait a simple word, a lifted eyebrow, a turn of hand. They have him where they want him. Revelation or disgrace, they'll know whose side he's on. Christopher is rhythmically kicking a pasteboard carton which used to contain a magic trick. He is not happy with paradoxes. And then we see they've turned her loose. A cruel turn. She can't run from the stones nor catch them when they start to fall like hail. Look, her face is wide behind her spread hands and white. The child's an open lily, her pale lips rounding the syllables of no. And all hangs still in the impossible thick air until some young boy's patience is worn through and the first stone from the shadows wakes her to the fruits of sin for sure. Then Jesus moves, cleaving the mob, which like the sea under his hands turns still and stands at her side and bites off the word of challenge. And they don't stop to think about it, though the smell of blood is in their brains. They splinter like a smitten block. More like a cast directed by John Huston, Janet says. And sure, one could say that, or one could say a lot of things, but Christopher will have it this way. In the instant of relief, she gives a sign that lets her Savior know that she has only one way of saying thank you, and that certainly she would be glad to oblige. And Jesus holds his hands in hers and says in Aramaic, "Thanks, but there are better ways to serve. And how can you love others until you have the sure foundation of loving and respecting yourself as God loves and respects us all?" And let us hope, says Christopher, that unlike some, she takes his word to heart and turns her life around. "Said like a man," says Janet, who'll confuse the response with the stimulus. And that seems like a good place to leave this, with those two not yet at each other's throats, tiny Janet and bearded, earnest Christopher searching out the meaning of the parable, and the chastened woman looking up at Jesus of Nazareth, wondering what kind of man this is who would turn down a sincerely offered piece of ass, and all of us, for 2 millennia to come, acknowledging our sins, looking up toward our Savior, desperately searching through our pockets or purses for something to give up that's good enough, as long as the skies and the stones don't fall. I did a series about the elements. These are 4 poems about the elements that people used to think made up everything: earth, air, fire, and water. in four different voices. The first is called Earth Rejects the Early Plow. I have a headache. Iron's cold. It scratches like my nerves are being pulled out. All they want is to get it in and over with. Their idea of foreplay is dance or sacrifice, as if the blood of lambs or virgins lubricates. But let them stay a while. They know my turning and my shifts of weight and how in time my dreams will drift toward flowers opening and wet life working into cracks in stone. Soon I'll want to touch myself and it will tap my bones, the old sweet current, and I'll stretch and swell toward their feet, spreading to plow in sunshine. It's like a hunger when it comes on me, like an appetite for folding in. Understand, I can be hard as flint or round and full of nourishment like fruit. But when the season comes, then I am hollowed with a space shaped like a seed that wants the thrust of planting to be whole. The wind's confession. Your life is crazed like a chapel window telling an allegory now obscured. Hard to say whether from age alone or whether something struck it from outside. Listen, I can get my fingers into cracks smaller than you can measure to repair. That's why you feel a draft for all the rags of doctrine here and there, wrapped in your gown and headgear on the altar, your skin ruddy in the fire of the sacrament. Pay attention to the pricking of your thumbs. That will be me, inside already, making good my promise. The music of my passing is cold, like plain song. You should know I can lift you toward the splintered light, and I can let you go. Fire, the old reprobate, caught red-handed, cops a plea. I have annealed and pasteurized, choked, lit, and rendered, carried goods, put your footprints on the moon. If I bring loss to some, why I do it without spite, with perfect equanimity. The plan of God who spoke me into blaze and wielded me in vengeance and cast me down alike upon the heads of saints and liars, whores and kings, is all I need of pretext and ample mitigation. Think of the pinion pines, those noble hangers-on. No good without me, their seed couched in its virgin cones in cradling grass, until I come and lick them open with my tongue. Water, having found her own level, sulking. I have been a traveler in high places, higher than airplanes go, so high that everything above is black and what's below blues into hazy nothing. And I have loved to fall and flow and billow vaporous and spin down to delicious drift, always working my way under, deep, where thaw is and the Heracliton fire toward beginning. These days you see so little rise in anything. Dim sun can't lift the ice. Currents slowed by something sink and burrow in the deep mud, barely throbbing. Only sometimes I think back to times of tidal surge and flooded streams and long for the feel of those distant parts of me gone out like offspring. Gone to work on all that's raised up, all that's rough, stretched to the outer edge of touch, just turning to come in. A next to last new poem. I'm not sure whether I'm going to call it occasional self-analysis dedicated to Karen Horney, the psychiatrist who invented that term, or just an act of contrition. Dear God, I'm a corner bar in a changing neighborhood on some Midwestern city's near south side. My old German drunks, such fixtures I could set the clock by their getting up to piss, their seventh cigarettes. Outside, through plate glass smoked like old world fish, tattered with colored flyers from a generation back, announcing the neighborhood events whose fading images collect in frames behind the bar, flocks of stocky women, working men, whose names no longer matter even here. Through these windows, I say, these windows out of me, I watch the corner turning, hear the jive of streetwise kids who waited out in bus stop shelters selling crack, trading pussy for what feels so good no German could ever admit it was.
Oh, my dear God, I am trapped in here. What grim spell might free me, I don't know, nor where I'd go if all at once the door swung open and those sudden kids, their knit caps tilted back on their shaved heads, entered like a jury of my peers, appraising the querulous lot of us, a verdict forming in their narrow eyes. One last poem and then an epilogue. This is called Cutting Up Fruit. Standing at the sink with all the summer that's left outside the window, peering in, carving melons, slicing berries, you whistle softly while a dozen friends dance to different music on our lawn. I watch the way your hands converge. The quick knife slips through the pulp and leaves the merest rind next to your skin, and all so fast I hold my breath. But left and right your hands dance like old partners, sure of steps and place. I wish that we had danced that way. You are not looking at me, nor at the summer wanting in to say goodbye, nor at your work, but at someone miles and years away. Your hands, I understand, move by themselves. Me, I'm about my business, making thicker slices, clumsily knowing my failure in the bone, thinking, only act as if you know how hard I try. For all I want of grace and dignity, love what you can of me, and I may learn the steps in time. The quick tick of your wedding band against the stainless knife is the rhythm of your whistled tune and all I have to go on. Outside on the pleasant lawn, no shudder passes through our guests, nor do they pause in their dancing as something, maybe summer, goes away. And I want to close the way I always do, for my wife, for Catherine. I am with you, a boat at sea, one with your rising and with your ebb. I spread myself like sail to catch your breath. Move me where you will.